and politics being right. I've been right about everything. Everything in my movie, Fixing America, is right. China's a giant problem. I made it in 2011. I said in the movie, when we pass $20 trillion of borrowed debt, we're never going back. We won't pay the interest on the debt. There's a one-minute video you can go watch where everything explodes. Now we're at $26 trillion, 27 maybe now. Being right doesn't help in politics.
Hey, everybody. I'm Sam Coates, and this is the Driven By Podcast. Life's a lot more fun when you're all in and passionate about what you're building. Here, you'll hear me with entrepreneurs, operators, executives, and public servants from all over the country. They'll discuss their commitment to their craft, defining moments, what's made them successful, where things are headed in their space, plus so much more. This podcast is produced by the team at drivenbysamcoates.com. And for more information and episodes, go to drivenbysamcoates.com/podcasts. Before we get to today's episode, here's a quick word from our sponsor for today's podcast. AB Jets is a great story. Started very small with an entrepreneur and a dream, and it's now one of the largest Lear 60 jet companies in the United States. AB Jets has received the prestigious Argus Platinum rating the last 8 consecutive years, which goes to less than 5% of operators in the world. So bypass the hassle and fly private. Go to abjets.com for more information or call them at 888-520-JETS. Hey, everybody. Here is my conversation with Steve Laffey. Steve is a politician and businessman who ran for mayor of his hometown, Cranston, Rhode Island, and won. Steve is a former executive at Morgan Keegan and Company. He's an author and filmmaker. After serving as mayor of Cranston, Rhode Island, Steve ran for the Republican primary for the United States Senate and the Republican primary for the House of Representatives, where he was not successful. In 2023, Steve announced he would run for the Republican nomination for the 2024 United States presidential election, and he withdrew from the race in 2023. Steve is the author of Primary Mistake, How the Washington Republican Establishment Lost Everything in 2006 and Sabotaged My Senatorial Campaign. In 2012, Steve released the film Fixing America, a documentary. Steve currently lives in Fort Collins, Colorado. Please enjoy this conversation with Steve Laffey. Steve, great to see you.
Sam, thanks for having me out here.
Yes, sir. Who is Alan Morgan?
Alan Morgan is, in my life, one of the, if not one of the most important, the most important figure, along with John Stokes, in my certainly my professional career. And I just think he's done so much for Memphis. And my 9 years of living in Memphis, I have the maybe the unique perspective that I was his partner at the very beginning. And we are, the in many ways, the opposites, right? He's more reticent. But I love being at Morgan Keegan because his honesty and the way his forthrightness and his simple way of running the firm allowed me at one for 9 years to kind of do whatever I wanted. Who can say that? You know, I was the president, the COO. In fact, I was the one who told him I had to become the president. I didn't let him tell me. I said, you need to make me the president one day in my office. Alan had a special way of dissing everything. He had a special way of arguing. It's very, very unique, very unusual. And he would always say, well, you're too young. You haven't been here long enough. And I'd be like, no. You fly at 40,000 feet. I'm the crop duster. You know, I said to him, you know how we argue in these commitment committee meetings and people are like horrified? He goes, yeah. Why is that? And I said, because they just kissing your ass. And I'm not. I'm telling you what I think. And you know this. And so we need a bad cop. And I'm the guy who has to be the president so we can restructure this firm because there's still a lot of things that have to be done. And I had been his partner in sales. And that's how I met him at the, I wanted to run an investment banking firm before I was 40. That was sort of my goal. I had a couple of goals. One, I wanted to have enough money I could do whatever I wanted because I grew up poor. Two, I wanted to have a family that was the opposite of the one I grew up in. That's really where my career goals. It wasn't anything more than that. It was simple. And the man who hired me at Payne Weber, I went to him and said, I got to do this. And he knew someone at Morgan Keegan. And I got a phone call to meet Alan Morgan at the Pierre Hotel on Good Friday of 1992. And I didn't realize that Alan always stayed at the Pier Hotel because
he was— Where's that? New York?
It's in New York City. It's a highfalutin hotel. Because he wasn't allowed to go in it when he was a teenager to meet his father, who ran First Tennessee Bank. Because he had come over from Europe, and he told me the story later, and they wouldn't let me in. He hadn't shaved, he was dirty, whatever it was. And he said, when I get some money, I'm always going to stay there. That's how he thought. And so I met him over breakfast, and I had my computer, and I did international sales along with having been a trader at Payne Webber. And I pulled out the computer, and I'm telling him my clients. Now, the unusual part about Alan Morgan was that even though the firm did $100 million in revenue, he still had a retail book, and he still sold institutional stocks to people in Europe. And that's what I was doing. So when I'm talking about Christine Ross at, you know, Scottish Life, he knows her. He knows who she is. So I'm showing every conversation I've ever had, and I'm telling him, I'm hitting him like I'm hitting you. I'm talking, and he's sitting there, and he just says to me one thing. He says, you know, I'm not going to swear, but he says, you know, I thought this was another BS meeting that Graves set up, quote, unquote. Why don't you come down and be my partner? And I said, okay. He said, what do you need? I said, I just need to tell my wife that I'm going to make one more dollar than I make now. He said, how much do you make? I told him. He said, okay. I don't remember anything else other than that. And I had never been South, effectively. One summer I worked down in New Orleans, but I wasn't from the South. I'm from Rhode Island. I was educated at Bowdoin College in Maine, at Harvard Business School. I worked in New York City. So we went down there. My first wife and I went down. And my first wife, when we got to the hotel room after meeting everybody, was crying. And I said, we don't have to do this. We don't have to do this. And she said, no, this is going to be very good for you. These people are going to be very good for you. John Stokes, Alan Morgan. But I became Morgan's partner along with Haywood Henderson in international sales. And over a year and a half, I would say things like, you know, Alan, I'm going to go to Finland. He goes, what? They only did business in London, a little bit in Edinburgh. One guy was doing France. I said, let's go to Denmark. See, the margins were big. And I would give him an answer. Here's why I'm going to do it. I'm going to make two trips a year. We're going to do $400,000 gross. And it's going to cost an extra $3,000. And he always would say something like, okay. And I would do it. It would be successful. So even when I got into management, it wasn't Alan, I think, who wanted me to leave. But I said to him, Alan, we're the biggest producers in the firm now. It's been a year and a half, 2 years, whatever I've been here. I've proven myself in what you think is really good, sales. So if you're listening and you're trying to find out what the CEO thinks is important, Alan thought sales was important. I thought it all was important, but I did sales with him. So I played tennis with him. And he was the kind of guy I'd say, I would say, honestly, Alan, at the very beginning of meeting, of working there, do I need to play golf? All you guys play golf. I kind of suck at golf. He'd be like, he said, no. He said, your personality, it's going to frustrate the living, you know, what out of you. Just play tennis with me. He played tennis also. So I meet him at the Memphis Country Club to play tennis, maybe every other week for 9 years. And for, I'll give you an example. I would lather up with sunblock. He would say, can I have some of that sunblock? He'd take a pea amount of a size of a pea on his thumb or his finger, and he put it in the tip of his nose. I let this go on for a couple of years. And then finally I said, Alan, are you just busting my chops? What do you do? This is not covering your face. We're out in 95 degree weather. So he has a very good sense of humor. But the thing that everybody respected about Alan that I loved, I can tell you stories where it was all about his ethics were so high. One time I was sitting in front of him and he was turning down, I was in sales, but he was standing near me. He was turning down $1 million fee for a company located in Eastern Europe. And he said, we're never going to be able to cover the company. What's going to happen? We're going to get $1 million check. In 3 years from now, we're going to lose $1 million on the trading desk, or we're going to lose the money. We're not going to be able to cover it. So he was very focused on this. And so when I got into management, for example, I'll give you an example. There was a Birmingham branch. They owned like four stocks, not 15 stocks, not the 60-40. They owned like four stocks that no one had ever heard of, including one called Isolizer that I thought was going to go to zero back in the day. And I went up to him and I said, listen, I've got to go visit a guy you've known for 30 years. Wonderful guy. I'm going to go down there and tell him he has to get out of these stocks before we get sued, and we're going to lose $50 million if we get sued. I'm going to get him out of these stocks in 2 months, or I'm going to get him fired. Can I go? He said, go. I go down. I sit with a really nice guy. I explained to him that this is totally outrageous. It's not a we will lose the prudent man rule. It's in Alabama where they file these class action lawsuits all the time. And you got to do this, and I'm going to come back in 2 months, and if it's not done, I'm going to fire you. And I wasn't the head of retail. I come back. I go to the 21st floor. Did I call you? Yes. What did I say? He said, that damn blah, 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 Yankee, you need to get rid of him, blah, blah, blah. And I said, what'd you tell him? He said, I told him to do everything Steve Laffey said and do it now. You know, if he said you could do it, he would 100% back you up. And so there were things like that. I took over different parts of the, and Stokes was instrumental, John Stokes, because he would push that because I think he knew that I had the right answers to change the firm from a local yokel, you know, guys from Memphis kissing butt, not working as hard, to bringing in people that could make us a better firm. And that's what I ended up doing by running different divisions of the firm. When I took over research, we didn't have a managing director who was a research analyst. I said, that's unacceptable. These research analysts feel like second-class citizens. How am I going to bring other people in? So we made them managing directors. We did a lot of things. And I changed the whole compensation structure of the research department. And from it was always commission-based. I'm like, we need these guys to pick stocks so we can raise assets. So I took over the focus list. We changed that. And within a year and a half, we were the number one stock-picking firm in the country, according to the Wall Street Journal, which made us the top story on CNBC, which helped us grab assets and mail stuff out. But all that was done with me going to Alan and saying, I'd like to do this. He'd say, why? He would try to diss it to see if you really had done the work. And then he would say, okay, go. And then he would back me up. And that's how I took over different divisions and we did different things and we were successful.
Is it true that you care very little what people think about you?
That's true, I think. Yeah, I think I would have to say that's pretty true.
Is there an experience in your life that got ingrained in you?
Probably from my childhood growing up. I had a very troubled family, but by the grace of God, I grew up with families that took care of me outside, that teachers kept an eye on me. My father did not want me to go to college, for example. My oldest brother he was very troubled. He was a homosexual at a time when you didn't talk about these things. And he came down with AIDS and he died. He had tried to kill me when I was about 16. By bashing me over the head with a giant colander full of pancake stuff that probably weighed 7 pounds. He missed, only because my other brother, who is schizophrenic and has real mental problems, I moved and he missed. He got half of my head, but he didn't get my whole head. And so there was lots of issues like that. My mother didn't really want me to be successful, I don't think. My father, out of fear of how anybody would pay for college, because he didn't go to college. He was a toolmaker, right? Grew up in the Depression. And the kids having so many problems that he said, you could be a toolmaker like me. I remember forgetting it was yesterday. And I remember sitting at a desk. Kids were out fooling around, running around, and I'm sitting at home studying. And although I had a lot of fun outside the house, but I'd say, Dad, do you see this calculus book? I'm going to college. And so maybe it's that process of just from my childhood family life and thinking through that I've got to do this, that I didn't much care that, and sometimes it can be a problem. For example, I mean, to take the big picture, when I left Morgan Keegan at the age of 38, whatever it was, I was the youngest president, COO. We started the investment banking, you know, the private funds that there. I ran them. I was in charge of them. I had the carried interest in them. Most of the carried interest in those funds. One became very successful. I was supposed to go run JP Morgan. I was supposed to, you know, do something else. And I didn't. I checked out. I guess you have to say, did I really care what people thought? People thought I was nuts to go run for mayor of Cranston. Did people put in $1,000? They did. Did Alan Morgan write the first check? He did. I said, Alan, you got to write the first check. Did Dick Fork write the second? You know, but they didn't think it was a great idea for a guy who was making well in the seven figures and to go make 80 grand a year to fix a small city, you know, 80,000 person. But I did. And so I didn't really care what anybody thought. I thought I should have been in the military. I wasn't. I thought I could at least do this. And so things like that have happened quite a bit.
Military from a patriotic standpoint?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't in my family. No one talked about it. I never really thought about it. I thought about two things. I can't have a family like this. I didn't speak in my own home. I mean, you know, think about growing up and not speaking. Then I could talk to you for 17 straight hours and not get tired, right? So outside my home, I'm the president of the student council. You know, I'm the captain of the basketball team. I'm out all the time and people, I'm with people. So I think a lot of that process came down to like, I should do this when I had this vision that I should go to Cranston. And then it became that I should be the mayor and I could fix this. And then I could do my public service because I'm 38. I'm not going to enter the military. I'm not going to join the CIA. I didn't think that. But by the time I started thinking about this stuff, which I should have thought about when I was younger, but no one in my family did. No one told me about it. So that was sort of maybe part of the process of why I should do it. And I never gone back. You know, I failed. I've never done anything for 20 years but try to convince the country that we're going broke. Made a movie about it. Wrote a book about how to fix the Republican Party. Ran for president to tell people these are the five things that we have to do. Please listen, because it's almost over. My movie is like a, you know, being the Jeremiah of the, of a secular Jeremiah saying, this is going to happen if we don't do this. And now I'm saying, this is happening. It's happening now.
Yeah.
It's starting to happen now. And we still have nobody who would do anything about it. But I failed, and failing is not fun, but at least there's a body of work where I'm right. So I think this corollary is that I have to be right. It's more important to me to be right than care that people thought that I should have done this.
AB Jets is a great story. It started very small with an entrepreneur and a dream, and it's now one of the largest Lear 60 jet companies in the United States. AB Jets has received the prestigious Argus Platinum rating the last 8 consecutive years, which goes to less than 5% of operators in the world. So bypass the hassle and fly private. Go to abjets.com for more information or call them at 888-520-JETS. There have been times in my life where others that I've been close to, biologically connected to, where their own suffering and hardship, that's affected my own identity, and that's affected my own thoughts on myself. You've talked a little bit about your childhood, your siblings, your parents. What do you think gave you the confidence or the drive to not let those things affect the dreams and aspirations that you had for yourself?
I have to say that God, even though I'm not making fun, I grew up Roman Catholic, and I didn't read the Bible, and I went to church on Sunday morning, and I went and saw the priest on Saturday afternoon, confessed my sins, and I went out and committed them again, generally speaking. And I'm not making fun of it. There's lots of wonderful Catholic, evangelical Christian now. But we had Bibles everywhere. No one opened them. That was sort of standard in my neighborhood or where I come from, Irish Catholic neighborhood. But literally, God looked out for me. There's no doubt in my mind. Why would someone not be affected by what was happening around them? Why would someone go to junior high school, first day of class, teachers taking down names, you haven't been to the school, it's a new, you know, seventh grade, and they're like, Steve Laffey. The look in the eyes like, are you John and Michael's brother? Yes. And the look is like one of just horror. My brother's putting cigarettes out in his arm. I mean, you know, neither one of them finished high school, you know, and I'm a good student. So I always say this, and it's true, and this is why I went back to Cranston, I guess. God sent me back there, but all I did was one thing in public service was to fix the worst-run city with the lowest bond rating about the default on its debt, and we did that. I guess I did something, right? So it's okay. It's not like the worst thing. But the Bennett family across the street, it's a very famous hockey family. The oldest son, the six brothers, played for the NHL for the Inland Flames. They were tough kids, and I was at their house. I was never at my house. And my best friend, Peter, who my son is named after, drowned at the age of 11. I moved in at 4. He came across the street, said, would you be my best friend? I said, yes. He was a big hockey player. They all played for the NHL. And Billy Bennett still runs his Cranston, you know, sporting stuff and the Bennett Sports. But they really took care of me, along with other families. And, you know, I write about in my book, the Oradenka family. He went to Columbia Law School, one of the few guys in the neighborhood. And he would yell at people on the phone when I was around. I'd be like, I could do that. I can yell at people. I could go to Columbia, whatever it was. I went to Bowdoin in Harvard. But so I always had that. And I think Peter dying, he was a leader. He drowned with his skates on. It was the worst.
He fell through the ice.
He fell through the ice. It was just, I can't even bear it. I didn't, you know, and here's what happened in my family. They sat me down, told me he had drowned 2 hours earlier. That's all they said.
Your mom or dad?
That's all they said. No one said another word. I didn't speak about it till I was 18 years old. I went to the funeral. They took me there. Then they dropped me off at the Providence YMCA afterwards. And the thing I remember is that one of the parents had to take us to lunch. It was not safe to walk out of this Y in Providence. We had to walk over to this lunch place. And she said, Stephen. Now, she didn't know I knew Peter Bennett. It was a front page story. It's a famous hockey family across the street. And she said, what's wrong? And I said, well, my best friend died and I just came from the funeral. Who? Peter Bennett. Well, she had read the front page story. Everybody in the state of Rhode Island knew the Bennett family. It's a famous hockey family. father was the backup goalie for Jacques Plante. I mean, is, you know, and she knew I was in shock, and she went to a phone and took me with her, and she dialed and told my parents, you need to come pick this kid up. She asked me my phone number and put me back in that car, and I went home, but no one spoke about it. It was just a terrible, terrible thing. So, you know, there were good families that took care of me. And I'm not mad at my mother or father. I'm not mad. It just, this is what it was. It's pretty realistic. You know, you come home and you're running for mayor and your brother has been arrested. Or, you know, he's as I said, he tried to burn down the Institute of Mental Health while I was the mayor. The Institute of Mental Health for the state of Rhode Island is in Cranston. It's not like saying we're sitting here in Memphis. It's somewhere in Nashville. It's right there. It's a front page story. So I think I just sort of be able to distance myself from things and remember my childhood in a much merrier way than maybe what happened. And maybe that's the only way I could have survived and decided I'm not doing this. But I remember at 12 saying, I'm not doing this.
You're going a new path.
I'm not having a family like this. And by the grace of God, I was able to succeed in that.
Could you describe or explain Morgan Keegan for listeners to this that have never heard about Morgan Keegan?
Morgan Keegan, at the time, was started in 1969 by Alan Morgan, who borrowed, as he told me, $500,000 from his father, who ran First Tennessee Bank, because his father had two children. One was a real estate developer, and he said, you got to build houses all the way out toward Nashville. Okay, we need good houses. And he told his son, Alan, this is a bad place for bonds. There's bond daddies or whatever they're called, a lot of corruption. Need a real brokerage firm so the city can be a real city. So Alan started Morgan Keegan after working for several years for somebody else. By the time I got there, it was $100 million in revenue, but it was still a local, lots of people were from Memphis. They knew Alan, they knew Stokes, Stokes being the vice chairman. It wasn't going to be a national firm if we didn't make changes. So I guess what I represented when Alan asked me to be his partner was a guy who then, you know, showed up at 3 o'clock in the morning. You'd walk into that building, my car, my truck actually would be sitting there. Everybody would see it. And as I got into management, I was trying to professionalize things that just weren't professionalized. They had some analysts that, if they weren't from Memphis, they wouldn't be analysts. They, you know, they had some people. I'm not saying they weren't good people. I'm just saying that in order to compete with what the world that was changing, and I saw very clearly that we weren't going to be a commission-generated firm. We were going to be asset managed. But in the city, there were like, in my humble opinion, there was Fred Smith, there was Pitt Hyde, Federal Express, AutoZone, and there was Alan Morgan. Alan Morgan firm was smaller than those other firms, even when I joined. But those were the three juggernauts of people who actually sat around and said, we've got real problems. How do we fix some of these problems? I'll give you an example. Getting to management, Alan comes to me and says, now that you're in management, you got to join this charity, nonprofit. And I want you to donate $10,000 to it and help them out. I did. That's what I did. I did the best I could. So we did things like I went to the Caldwell School. I brought 30 people from Morgan Keegan to teach first graders needs versus wants and fourth graders a production operation management thing about making a pen. And I will tell you that even then, I was so horrified because I come from New England and didn't deal with some of the issues that happened in Memphis. But the first graders were bubbly and I was white and they were all black, the kids, Caldwell School. And I brought in some white people, but the rumor went around because I wore glasses back then that I was Bill Gates. And one of the teachers says, they think you're Bill Gates. Only because I was the only white person they knew and I wore these big glasses like Bill Gates did. And I wasn't Bill Gates and I'm thankful I'm not Bill Gates. He has a lot of money, but I wouldn't want to be a Bill Gates. But the fourth graders were sort of gone. Like that by first to fourth grade or first to fifth grade, I was watching kids that weren't going to survive and be productive and didn't want to learn. And I was just... Now, I couldn't do anything about it because I had to go back to work. But Morgan Keegan and the other firms like Bob Thompson at RFS Hotels and Dean Jernigan, who we built a AAA ballpark with from Storage USA, they all represented that they cared about the city a great deal, even though the demographics and the problems were overwhelming and have overwhelmed, in many cases, downtown Memphis, which is why I just came from people who moved to Rossville. So Mississippi was growing. But it was just very sad. But Morgan Keegan represented sort of the It was the highest per person paid operation in the state of Tennessee. It represented sort of a white shoe, you'd say, wealthier part where people went and did well. But a lot of them contributed to back to Memphis, but also represented sort of the localized version of a firm that had to become national. It wasn't going to survive. And I clearly knew that coming from New York. I may have been the only one at the time, but I think John Stokes knew it very clearly. And I think Alan did too, that there were problems that had to be changed. And I represented that change for good or bad.
So you're from Rhode Island.
Yeah.
You went to Harvard. You went to school in Maine. You've lived in New York. You lived in Memphis. You live in Colorado now. What can you say about the good old boy network, but then how the world actually operates if you want to compete?
Yeah, the good old boy network had to be broken down. And unfortunately, after Morgan Keegan was sold and I left, there was no more bad cop. I mean, there's nobody actually firing people when they had to be fired. I mean, I can give you a story. We fired a guy on the trading desk. I told him not to trade certain stocks. He handled the firm's money. He traded that stock again. I went to John Stokes before I went to Morgan. I ran the trading desk right to the end, even though I was president of the firm. But at one point, I said, I'm going to fire this guy because no one can mismanage the money. It's one thing if somebody, you know, is an analyst and has a bad opinion or whatever. But money is how Baring Brothers and Merrill Lynch whale trade and firms go down when someone mishandles the money. Stokes was, well, by God, we gotta go talk to so-and-so, you know? So let's bring in Terry Graves. What does he think? So Terry had run the trading desk. And I have nothing against Terry Graves, who had run the trading desk before me and was the guy who was actually the guy who made the call to get me to meet with Alan Morgan. And what do you think, Terry? What do you think about this? And Terry's, you know, well, I don't think we should give him another chance. And Stokes is like, and that's why Laffey's running the trading desk. Because he knows what the hell to do. You're going to have to fire his ass. Now, you're not going to throw him out of his ass. We're going to give him some severance. And, you know, so things like that would happen. And I would go to Stokes all the time. And there was a guy, they would hire people who had no business being salesmen. And I was starting to bring in people from around the country. Because back in the day, in the 1990s, Northwest Airlines, KLM, was really the place to be. Memphis was a second hub. We were flying direct nonstop to Amsterdam. We were three direct flights to Los Angeles. If you're in investment banking, that's what you need. Get home, get your people home. Nashville didn't have this. So the good old boy network was so strong, that's ultimately why, although I never have really talked about it, why I ended up leaving the firm and after we sold the firm. And it was actually, I was quite happy. I really didn't think, I kind of, again, Alan's a CEO. He sent me to the CEO roundtable. Effectively, he allowed me to make a lot of these decisions. It was a wonderful 9 years. And I must tell you, when I come back to Memphis like today for a different reason, it is very sad because I loved living in Memphis. They may not have loved having me, but I loved the people. I loved people. I couldn't understand what they were saying. I loved going out to see people dressed like Elvis. I loved all the characters like Memphis and May. The story I always tell that I was so glad I never, ever opened my mouth. I walked up to the 15th floor and I'm looking out. It's, you know, there's land all on the other side over in Arkansas. It's like, all this land. And I'm like, why aren't there any homes? But I don't say anything. And I'm saying, one day I looked out, it was covered with water. And I guess this is why it's called the Bluff City, right? But I never said, hey, where are the homes? Thankfully, because it goes like 20 miles, right? But I was so focused on work that I didn't get to enjoy as much as maybe I would have if I didn't have a different mission, which was like, I've got to be the president of this firm before I'm 40.
What was Harvard like for you?
Harvard was extraordinarily hard because I was the youngest in my class. So this is, I wanted to be the next Milton Friedman. I was an economics major. And once I saw Free to Choose in 1979-80 in high school, Paul Zissin, the economics teacher, made us watch it and I loved it. And I wasn't supposed to go to college, but another teacher, Dave Andrew, said, I went to Bowdoin College. The director of admissions is my classmate. You need to drive up there and see him. And I did, without my parents. No one came. Drove an old Galaxy 500 up there, so I did very well. But I was going to get my PhD in economics, except for one day I walked out of Hubbard Hall with Bill White. And, you know, if you're a college, you see the Vanderbilt sign, you see the law school at Harvard, you see Harvard Business School. There's all these things where you can go to graduate school at Bowdoin. And Bill says, I'm going to Harvard Business School one day. I said, wow, what's the deal? He goes, well, I got to go work for a couple of years. They don't take you right in out of college. They don't take anybody in out of college. I said, why not? He goes, I don't know, but they just don't. You have to go work. I'm going to go work for Morgan Stanley. I'm going to go work here. Then I'm going to apply. I'm going to go in. Right then, I walked out in 19, this would have been 1979 in May, early May, late March, March to May. I said, I'm getting in directly. I don't know why I said this. I'm going directly out of college. And nobody did. Nobody still does, I guess. So I had friends get applications. But remember, I never took an accounting course. I never took anything but theoretical economics, economic history, theoretical math, calculus, statistics, proving the gamma distribution is the whatever distribution with N minus twos of freedom, degrees of freedom, philosophy course, government courses. I didn't take any. My father wasn't in business. I scraped pans at a bakery as summer jobs. Like, I didn't have a family that was like, wow. So I got near perfect score on the GMATs. I applied. I retyped everything. And I had these different applications in case I made a mistake. I went up to Professor Shipman. I had five courses with, and I was like, can you write the greatest recommendation ever or I can't get in? You have to write that I'm the greatest student you've ever had. He was a full professor, and he said he would. I got in, and I went, and I show up in like a, I don't know, say a cutoff shorts and a ripped Bowdoin t-shirt, but people are wearing button-down, you know, shirts, and they've got slacks, and they've got shoes, and some are married, and I'm 22, and they're 27 on average, and a lot of people did like Bill White. They worked for 2 years, but they had, in my section of 90, you had world-class skiers. I don't know what was going on. And in accounting, and this is what I want to, so accounting is called control there, but you're not taking accounting. You know accounting, and you're the CFO of IBM, and you're reading a 20-page case every night and making decisions. So I don't know any of this. This is like showing up fifth year German and you've never spoken a word of German. That's what's going on around me. I don't know what to do about this. Now, the other courses like organizational behavior, I get excellence and you have excellent SAT. I do very well. Marketing, I get an E. Of course, my first comment in marketing, want to say hard, Mark Albion, the teacher, says something like, so blah, 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 product space where you put this blanket in a, you know, Best Buy on a shelf. And I make some comment like, oh, I'm just going to go and put it on the shelf. Obviously, that's not what happens. You don't just take, just so everybody knows, if you're listening, you don't take Campbell's soup cans and walk into a girl, just put them. You have deals. They're at eye level. There's a whole, I didn't know any of this. So I did get an E. Now, I had a theory because 55% of your class grade was class participation in most of your classes. So my theory was this. I would study one case no matter what, and I would dominate. Like, I would dominate this class, so the professor would have to remember me, because at Harvard Business School, you get 15% get satisfactories. There's no grade inflation. 70% get satisfactories. 15% get excellence. 70% get satisfactories, and 15% get low passes. You get too many low passes, you loop out. LP, loop out. I got loops in control, which is counting, and I got a loop in finance. I got E's in almost everything else. So I didn't loop out. But I couldn't be a Baker Scholar, which is like the top dog thing, you know, because I had these low passes. But I'm sitting up at night teaching myself accounting, debit cash, credit accounts receivable. To my left in my section sat Mike Stenson. If you look him up, he's the executive producer of many, many major movies. He's a world-class movie producer, and he went to Harvard undergraduate, and he's sitting next to me. And if you know accounting, you know there's something called FASB, Financial Accounting Standard Board, GASB, General Accounting Standard Board. I know all this now. Don't get me wrong. I'm a financial expert. I fix bad financial problems. Well, people would say, according to GASB, I do the LIFO method, last in, first out. According to GASB, I turned the mic on the third day. Who's this guy, FASB? I think it's a person like Milton Friedman, like Truman, like, I don't think it's, and Mike looks at me and he says, you're going to have trouble in this class. And I said, yeah. So Mike never spoke. He was a great writer. He didn't want to speak. I would sometimes look over at his notes and say, are you going to say this? He goes, no. I just raised my hand. So there were classes like production operation management. And I did this Burger King class. And so the professor would walk in. Once in a while, they'd say, who would like to open? And I was ready. And I went crazy on burgers and buns and I dominated. There was an organizational behavior class where I went after the CEO and the professor, Todd Jick, said, would you say that to that guy's face? And I said, I certainly would. And he brought him in. That was the surprise thing. He brings him in and I had to stand up to him and he defended himself and I'm going after him. And it was very, very hard. what happened in finance to me was that I said to myself, I'm going to keep taking these classes second year. And it all of a sudden clicked. Like something clicked about all the classes that I kept taking finance in, and it became very easy. But the first year, I mean, now at Harvard Business School, you joined like with five guys. You're a marketing guy. You worked for IBM. You, whatever. You're a salesman. You're an accountant. You're this. I was none of it. I had nobody to help me. Not that people didn't like me. I loved them. They loved me. I was popular in the class. My roommate, Joe Atencio, was a wonderful guy. He was in a section. But I had no added value. So I did everything myself. In some ways, it really helped me to dominate these classes where I would end up getting an E for the class. When I taught at the University of Rhode Island, I did the same thing to them. I taught the top finance course at the University of Rhode Island while I was mayor, and I made 55% of your class participation was your grade. And I didn't really want to give written tests. So I kind of taught the Harvard way. I taught case study method. It was really hard. But I really enjoyed it because, I'll just give you this one example. Harvard gets a good rap on the other side of the river because they're all liberal and they're whack jobs. Harvard Business School is very conservative. Not a blade of grass out of place. I mean, this is like, I would say this. I grew up and I would say, 10 guys, let's go play some basketball. I'll meet you down there in 2 hours. Five people show up. One's got a girlfriend, one's smoking dope, whatever happens. Bowdoin College, we're going to play flag football outside, 10, 5-on-5. We're going to meet you at 3 o'clock. Eight people show up. Pretty good. Two other guys. Harvard Business School. We're going to tip off at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. I call nine guys. I got the court for an hour and a half. Kirk Johnson time. At 9:15, 10 people are stretching out. And at exactly 9, the tip-off goes off and we play for an hour and a half. Never an exception.
Professionals.
Never. Someone borrowed a book. They gave it back on Tuesday by 5 o'clock. You needed it back. Tuesday at 4 o'clock, they came to your room. My section mates, I love dearly.
It's the best of the best.
It is. I can count on them.
Is that what you're saying?
When I run for president, they're the people helping me. You know, Eddie Wiziger's like anybody who has of you, I'm helping you no matter what. You probably can't win, but I'm sending you the max amount. So I have wonderful friends who, if I called today if I have a project for real estate, I'll call. And they call me. So, but it was very hard.
You were just saying that Harvard Business School, you talked about how it compared to anything else you've been a part of. Is there anything more there about the value, the network, the experience on how that influenced the trajectory of your life?
Well, it really truly did because I got engaged while I was there to my first wife, who went to Wellesley. And so I had to get a job and had all this stuff. So, but the influence is the ethics of the people that I was surrounded by. And I've never forgotten it. And I felt so blessed. And the story that really has never been told is that I didn't pay to go to Bowdoin College. It's a needs-blind school. I was accepted and walked out of there with maybe $1,000 of student loans, $1,000 for a school that cost much less than today, but adjusted for inflation. These are very expensive schools. When I got into Harvard Business School, the phone rang. And by the grace of God, I had just walked in the door and my brothers didn't pick up the phone. And my sister didn't say I didn't want to go. That's what they would have said. I picked up the phone. They called. And I said I was accepted. And I was like, wow. Then they tried to talk me into deferring on the phone because I hadn't worked ever. a real job. And I said, no, I'm coming. And then I thought, maybe I'm being deferred. I said, can I come? And I said, yes. But I had no money to go. I wouldn't have been. Harvard didn't care if you had the money. It wasn't like Bowdoin. They weren't going to. A man dies the next day who went to Bowdoin College and Harvard Business School. This is December of 1979. Of 1983. I go back to school in January and there's a Knox scholarship, KNOX. I'm the first recipient. It paid in full my tuition at Harvard Business School. Whose hand was in that? God, I couldn't go. I was accepted at Vanderbilt's joint program. I applied to law schools too. Vanderbilt's joint program, they offered me Dartmouth accepted me, University of Pennsylvania joint program. But Harvard, no one turns down Harvard Business School, just so you know the statistics on it. If you get in, you go. If you get to Stanford. And I think being there with the people that, in a way, were great help to me and highly ethical. I mean, the people, I'm sure there was someone who isn't. I'm sure. But like the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, which we owned seats and bought seats, highly ethical people. I wish I'd spent 10 years on the floor. That was the greatest experience of going down there all the time when I was at Morgan Keegan and go to the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. But the ethics of it, the work, I think, I'll give you an example. We, Harvard Business School decided during the pandemic, after it was over, we still couldn't go to Boston, even though we're like, I'm youngest at 58, 35, 3, whatever it was, reunion. And I got so mad that these people were trying to tell me what to do, that I went to all the section mates, the dean of the school, sent out a blast email saying, this is ridiculous. Like, Harvard Business School never needs to contact me about anything if you're this dumb. I don't even know what was going on in the pandemic, but I still would have come, but I get it. We can go now. So here's my section mates. We call the meeting, about 45 people on this Zoom call now. And we decide we're going to have our own. I said we should have our own. We have our own for the section. And the beautiful thing about Harvard is we put one person in charge, Chris Hyland. Chris calls me a week later, laughing. I've analyzed America where everybody lives. Forget about the guy in Australia, one of the guys in, you know, continental U.S. It looks like Denver's the best place that we can get plane flights to, and your house is the best place to go to. That's where the reunion was. Literally at my backyard. So it was beautiful. And here's the thing. Many of these guys, and they see me, I've retired, you know, I have these beautiful children and they love me and they make pies and they serve pies to Harvard Business School people with their wives and husbands. And they're out there and I've got it, and they can't believe it. They, you know, because the thing that is separates me from a lot of what's happened is that many of my section mates, they're still on this gerbil thing. They didn't change careers. They're still making money. They run large firms. But they don't, some of them have said to me, my kids are liberal. Well, almost all these guys are, ladies are conservative. They wouldn't be at Harvard Business School if they were like, you know, progressive whack jobs. So your kids are conservative. They're Christians. They love you. They're like, they're serving us pies. They're greeting us at the door. You made the right decision to get off the trap. But most of the people keep doing what they're doing forever and never stop. They make more money. They have more money than me. I have enough. So even when I saw Alan Morgan, the whole thing that happened with Morgan Keegan was just when the whole bond thing went down and took the firm down, the name had to be changed. This is because I wasn't there. I feel guilty about it, but it wasn't my job to be there. I wasn't there. I was the mayor. But when that whole thing started, the lack of ethics in that bond division and selling the same closed-end fund, that was the same thing and saying it was different. I told people, I got calls when the thing came out at 15, these closed-end bond funds, Morgan Keegan Select, whatever the heck, this disaster. When they came out, I got calls about buying it. These are great, they yield 10%. And they're like CDs. And I'm like, CDs yield 5%. This is back before the disaster of 08. What are you talking about? They're highly leveraged, lots of risk. That could be in 2% of your portfolio. Instead, they were in 50% of people's portfolios because the commissions generated on these closed-end funds are very high at the beginning, so everybody buys them. And then they all started to go to 12. And then I got calls saying, these things are even better. They're 12% yields or 15% yields. And I said, listen, there's only one thing I know. If the alternative is 5% in a bond, and this is 14, it's going to zero. It happens every single time, and yet people get sucked in. And because there was no bad cop at Morgan Keegan, me, or before me, Bill Dupree, it took the firm down. It took the firm down to the extent that I went to a wedding in Stuttgart, Arkansas, and someone said at the wedding, a relative of my wife, that guy was the president of Morgan Keegan. And he thought I was the guy, president of Morgan Keegan, yesterday. And he came at me to hit me because he had lost half his net worth in these products. He came out to hit me. And as he got closer, someone yelled out, he left in 2001. And so these things sort of haunt me about Morgan Keegan and about Memphis because it didn't have to happen. But greed runs a lot of things, especially in investment banking, especially in brokerage firms. That's why I left Payne Webber. That's why I loved Alan Morgan. That's why I loved Stokes. I said, well, let me just tell you something. Robert Montague, genius. I made a point to know, and I'm not a genius, but I made a point to know who the geniuses were and give them a lot of slack. Montague, one day we made more money in the trading desk than ever because I had to go find him because there was a short story about two of the companies he covered and the stock was plummeting and I found him and he said, it's not true. And I said, okay, I'm going to go buy the stock. I run the trading desk too. I'm going to buy the stock. You're right. He goes, I'm right. We bought like 30,000 shares and the stock was at 50 and it opened at 112. It's a big day for a firm like Morgan Keegan. That's because he was a genius.
And he's done so much good for this city.
I don't know that. I actually haven't talked to Robert in so long, but he's a genius. And I knew he's a Christian and a genius and a wonderful one, a big, tall man. And I haven't talked to him in a long time, but if I saw him, I'd give him a big hug because he was really an unusual guy.
I asked you this earlier. We kind of went a different place with it. But when you think about the things that you've done, the things you've been a part of, the things that you've seen, and then you also come to the Southeast and you talked about the Good Old Boy Network. What does the Good Old Boy Network not really understand about the way that the world works in other markets around the world?
Now, today I don't know, but back in the day I did know. For example, when I started at Payne Webber, I went to London, and it was the last remaining place where people were still really drinking at lunch, just to be blunt, in London, that I knew of, that I went to. And people would come back plastered. I couldn't keep up with I've never had a drink of alcohol in my life. I don't smoke. I don't drink. I had one cigarette with Peter Bennett. We coughed it, and we didn't do it anymore when I was a kid. I never did any drugs. I saw my older brothers and people doing this stuff, and I thought, I'm not doing it. And so, by the grace of God, I didn't. But the competitive nature is was not thrust upon them, but because if somebody covered California institutional-wise, and they knew Alan Morgan, and they hung out with so-and-so, there was never an account review like when I took over institutional sales, we did account reviews. No one had ever done one. The lady who ran the Boston branch, she wasn't a bad lady. She did a terrible job. I mean, she left over my account review with her. And people had heart attacks. I can't believe she's leaving. Oh, she's like, she's nothing. I mean, don't get me wrong. We hired a guy named Bill Hinckley, who I went to college with. He beefed up the business, acted professionally, did it professionally. I had him take over the New York office because it was run like a saloon. We had a problem up there. And Stokes agreed with me. We went to New York and we took care of it. So I could go on all day about these things we took care of, but the attitude that it would never change because people were comfortable. So in the end, if you had a big enough area, you could make 700 grand a year. And in Memphis, in 1995, 500 grand a year is like 2 million in New York City. So people are like, and they have this vested interest and they play golf with Alan. And so that was the whole problem of trying to professionalize the firm. But what they don't understand is that they're hurting the rest of the firm and the shareholders. And there wasn't much of the talk about the shareholders, even though Alan cared about the shareholders. But the inside group of Memphis who went to Memphis State or this or that, for the most part, never quite understood. And I represented a giant threat to that all the time. Not that people wouldn't say hello to me, not that people wouldn't have me over, but just by the way you can get from the way I talk, like I don't have a bone where it's like, it'll be okay. If it sucks, it's like, here's what we're going to have to do to make this better. I ran for president telling people, I ran for mayor telling people. When I think about it, Cranston was an ultimate old boy situation, you know, and it was in the Northeast. It was corrupt. The mayor before me overspent by $25 million, never told anybody. The mayor before him got caught with $150,000 of campaign cash, trying to buy annuities for himself. The mayor before him became the governor and went to jail on a land flipping deal. That was the mayor when I was a kid. So I think as I faced that in Cranston too, after I left Morgan Keegan, but I think it's oblivious. You know, the city is suffering. People are oblivious. They live in a certain area. When I lived here, the crime was like, don't go to Orange Mound. Like, you don't get stuck, be like out of a novel, right? And so, but I didn't have time to focus in on all the troubles. I don't have time to do certain things. But the old boy network, even within the city council, I can remember Minor Perkins, a totally great guy, head of investment banking while I was moving up and in charge of him after the end, but always felt like he was a partner. And he went to tell them about selling the water if they were broke. And they couldn't believe that we wouldn't take a fee if we didn't get paid. Like, we would do all this work. They thought we were the city council people. Not Mayor Harrington. His son worked for the firm. See, his son worked for the firm for a while. And he was a good guy. He actually, his wife owned something out at the airport, too. I haven't talked to him in a while. A long, long time. Nice young man. And but that's how people ended up getting hired sometimes. Not that he wasn't qualified, but they were an inside group. And I represented the ultimate outside, never been south effectively, except for a couple of months in the summer of 83, south of the Mason-Dixon line. Almost never been on a plane.
I guess to answer that question, you're saying people are comfortable and they don't like change. And they like to go only off relationships. And when you open things up, things that are competitive, things where you have to be accountable to what you produce.
Like, you didn't call this account. Like, you have this account in Detroit. It runs $1 billion to make up a number. The phone logs say you haven't called them in 3 years. We're going to give that account to somebody who will just call them. What do you care? All holy hell would break loose. One Friday, I had to fire like 4 people because they were backstabbing me and undermining the research department. And I went to and said, I'm going to get rid of these people. It was like a Friday night massacre at Morgan Keegan in a minor way. No one got hurt. People got paid severance and people went crazy. But then, like our foreign policy in the United States should be, people got it. Like, I'm not doing that. Like, Laffy's in charge. You know, he's going to back him if they have to get rid of me. And so that helped.
What have you learned about teams, about unity, people moving in the right direction, but also A players?
Stokes taught me this at the very beginning when I took over research. Laffy, you got like 30 days and then it's your problem. So you can build a team. And I did. Now, I was able through this kind of process to build a team. I'll give you an example. Kid named Tavis McCourt runs about everything at Raymond James today. I got him. He could have went anywhere as a research analyst. I had him for the summer. I made sure I kept in contact with him. I was trying to build a team with him. These young research analysts, the Brent Rakers of the world, I go on name after name. So the team was this. Give you an example. Everybody had to become a CFA in research. I made the rule. You go pass that test, we'll pay for the first time you pass the test, we'll pay for all the stuff you did. Second time, pass level 2, we're going to give you money. Pass level 3, you get money and you can become the youngest senior analyst in Wall Street if you can pass. And we did. We had people like that who they came to our firm because, like, that's what I want. That was the team that I wanted. And then when I changed how you got paid to, if you're O-rated stocks, it's not 1, 2, 3, 4 hiding behind an outperform or maybe outperform, all these things that Wall Street does. If your O's outperform the S&P 500, we'll get you a check. And at the end of the year, I used to produce a check the size of a PGA golf tournament winner, the guy who jumps in the lake. And I would bring out a check in front of basically the whole firm, but all of equity markets, be 7 feet long and 5 feet tall. And the first year I handed it to Robert Montague. Here's $100,000. And everybody said, holy, 100? This guy's not joking. So the team would build once they knew what was expected. And then all of a sudden we were blowing and going in research. And then I'd go to the retail. We're blowing and going here. You can trust this product. Go gather assets. Let's produce something. And those people did the same thing, the Tommy Orr's of the world. And then you have the other thing you have is that you have a situation where everybody knows there's a line that can't be crossed. I told you one about firing someone for trading. In the case of Joe Millsap, who's passed away, who I love dearly, who was the greatest salesman ever walked the face of the earth that I ever saw, and I saw a lot of them. This guy, when he was through with you, would have you buy anything. He could go to Edinburgh to that same Christine Ross with a one-page research thing. Tell her, what do you own? And blah, 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 blah. I own Lab A. I remember, and he would say, all right, I'm going to wait here while you sell every share of that and buy FICOR, PHYC. And she says, what are you talking about? That firm is guilty of fraud, waste, and abuse as defined by the statute of blah, 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 blah. Nothing. She says, I can't buy a piece of, you have a one-page thing. And he would say, Alex Brown, a competing firm, they have a wonderful thing. Put that in your file. It's 35 pages long. I don't do the 35-page thing. I'm just telling you what's happening. About 2 months later, on the tape, Lab A paying a $500 million, whatever it was, fine. Stock's down 30%. International phone is blinking. Christine Ross, sell every blah, 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 big margin business with her, and buy every share in these accounts, FICOR. He's a genius. And it's always at Morgan Keegan. It was about these retail clients, their mom and pops. Alan Morgan would, when I was president, he would walk in and say, could you call Mrs. Smith in Florida? She didn't get her statement last month. Do you think anybody at IBM is doing it? And I would call Mrs. Smith. Mrs. Smith, this is before, you know, Mrs. Smith, blah, 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 blah. I'm sorry, you didn't get a statement. We're mailing you another one. Oh, thank you. How is Mr. Morgan? I mean, she may have met him 25 years ago. So it was a unique firm. I had a unique position in it, never to be repeated in my lifetime. No one I know, I didn't make the most amount of money maybe I could have made. I made more than maybe I was, that I thought I was worth in many respects because Alan paid me well. Alan, at the end of the 6 months, would say when we were splitting up money in sales, he goes, you know, Steve, why don't you take an extra $50,000? I'd be like, what? Because we had a split system. he was a rich man. But he felt that I should have an extra 50 grand. And as the split changed, it became more in my favor. I never said anything to him after that first day about what he was going to pay me and what I was going to make. I made twice as much of whatever it was. And when the contracts came around, when the regions made them up, I didn't make up the contract. They made it up for me. I never had another word to him about compensation. Imagine that, in 9 years, never said a word about it.
What makes a great salesman?
I used to tell the retail brokers, one thing that makes a great salesman is that you, when people would join to be retail brokers, and I was not, I was institutional, I would meet with them, young people, and I would say, here's the deal. You're going to put your head down for 2 years and never look up. Like, if you can do that, you'll be successful. Here's the other thing you're going to do. This is what I did in sales. You're going to call. I had a rule that I would go to work before anybody would show up, and I would talk to 6 new people that day somewhere in the world, because it's a numbers game. Sales is a numbers game. And so I would call Denmark, and I'd find one guy. One guy had a wooden hand, by the way. He became a client. Strangest thing. I don't know if he was busting my chops. He let me shake it without telling me. But anyway, Henrik Renman in Sweden became a giant client of the firm. But it's a numbers game, and then you have to know what you're selling. In other words, don't sell things that you don't know what you're... Morgan Keegan had a niche in a certain thing, and I sold that. In addition, because of my background, I was able to, because I did international sales, give people a background in America and financial stuff like I did running for president that other people couldn't. So in doing that and consistently never giving up and finding new people and make it, these are the things that make you successful. The Morgan Henderson Laffey team was the biggest producer in the firm. But a salesman, successful salesman, doesn't forget. I used to write down every conversation. So, for example, I would walk, if you're going to get in sales, I would walk out of every meeting in London. Now, I wouldn't see these people again for 2 months, 6 weeks. Somebody in Sweden for half a year. I wouldn't go there all the time. But I would walk out, and before the next appointment, I would talk into a microphone. I just saw Henrik Renman in Stockholm, Sweden. It's November, blah, 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 1994. He's interested in X, Y, and Z. He's a tall man with blondish hair, whatever. And I would play that once every night, that tape of every day. Because if you don't do that, you forget. You forget who the guy, you know, you forget. He wants, and then so I would, then I would get home, and on the plane on the way home, I would write it all down. So it would all be sitting there. So if something happened that fit Henrik Renman, I'm just picking on him, or Mario Beccaria at Allianz in Italy, wonderful guy, in Milan, my only real big client in Milan, but I knew he could do something on the moment. He didn't have to get approval. Sometimes Christine Ross became my biggest client, wonderful lady. I would go in to visit her in Edinburgh, and she'd say, come to the Morgan Stanley. I'm going to have dinner there. Why don't you come get me and get me out of there? So I'd walk in, and she had announced to everybody, that's my biggest. They'd be, who? And then Morgan Stanley would call the next day and try to make me the head of the London, because I'm a Harvard Business School grad. But a salesman is going to say to themselves, this helps that client. I'll give you one example. Mario Beccaria could act on a minute's notice. Movie gallery, a company, is trading at $50 a share. I am certain one day it's going bankrupt. They're in a New York office for their last meeting before they do the offering. It's rallied to $50. Nobody's at the meeting, according to the New York office. Nobody comes. What does that mean? It's not being priced at $50. It's being priced at $40 or whatever. I call Mario. He's home. It's late at night. Mario, we need a short movie gallery right now. There's nobody at the New York office. It's $50 a share. It's rallied from 35. We can short it at 50, and tomorrow when it did the offering, you should cover it. Okay. We shorted 50,000 shares. The thing was priced at 44. He says on the phone, take half a buck commission. Thanks a lot. What I'm saying is that's what Christine Ross couldn't do that. She didn't short anything. You have to know what your customers can do, what they want, and give it to them. You give them a little more. You can try to persuade them in something. But if you're not giving them what they can do and want to do, you're doing them a great disservice. Some people couldn't buy small cap stocks. I would watch people keep calling about small stack stocks. I would never call them. I call them about Federal Express. I wouldn't call them about O'Charlie's, which is a restaurant chain that Stokes is on the board of. So I was very good at that and keeping that all in track and then expanding it. And then if you're in sales, here's the last thing. If you're growing your sales base in any industry, you need to fire your customers once a year. I don't care what date it is. And when I say that, I would tell Haywood, it's December 12th. I'm calling these 4 people. I've called them for a year. They haven't done any business with them. And I'm going to tell them we can't call them anymore. And Haywood, wonderful guy, he would have a heart attack. Morgan, I would say, no, watch what's going to happen. Because one, I'm totally wasting my time. They're not doing business with us. They've had, now in international sales, whatever client you have, it may be a year, it may be 2 weeks, whatever that's normal. But by a year, someone should say, I like Laffey, I like Morgan Keegan, whatever. And here's what would happen. That guy at Kazanoff, the oldest brokerage firm in London, he thought that the trading desk was doing business with us. He'd be like, what are you talking about? Guy in Switzerland the same way. What are you talking about? Well, we haven't done any business. I don't want to waste your time anymore. Like, you only can pick up the phone so many times. No, no, no. We've got to do business with you. And then we'd start doing business. So that's one outcome. The other outcome, the guy was just soaking information out of me and we weren't ever going to do business. So bring things at the appropriate time to a fruition, good or bad, and then move on. What did I do in the afternoon? No one had ever called Hawaii. I called Hawaii. No one ever called Japan. I'm sitting there all day long. I go to Alan Morgan. Alan, I can't do business with these Japanese firms until we go to New York and meet them. They run the money. We can't go visit them. They won't see me because the book says we have to visit with the CEO in Japan. He's like, what? You have to go with me to Japan. And here's the deal. Once I say you're coming, the book says they have to see us. All this was true. I called the head of Daiwa Securities, big firm. The guy was a kamikaze pilot. Alan and I go to Europe. They lost my suit. It's a funny story. Anyway, I find out, have him make a suit at the airport because Alan had a suit on. We go all week long. Alan's still ordering cheeseburgers for lunch, and he does eat Peking duck at dinner one night. Still ordering ham and eggs, whatever, bacon and eggs for breakfast. We have a wonderful time. We do all these meetings, and I go to New York, and we do business. But Alan was the kind of guy, he needed a rationale. And I, as a salesman, before I got to management, would say, you got to do this for 1 week. He'd never been there. I'd never been there. We never went back. We didn't have to go back. We called May J Life in New York. So you have to take these extra things. But the thing that was positive for me about the old boy network, how could someone have not called Hawaii Trust? How could someone have not called these people? They exist. They're in books. They run money. No one had ever called them. And I did. And one last thing about sales. Know what the boss ultimately does if you're moving up in sales. Alan did, as I said, international sales. I did international sales. Don't do something else if you want to move up in a firm. Find out what the CEO, find out if the CEO was a salesman in Colombia and find your way to Colombia, then meet him at a big firm and he'll say, you sell stuff in Colombia? That's what I did. You're generally not going to get fired. CEOs want someone to do what they think is important. That's how I ended up at Morgan Keegan.
And you followed that blueprint.
I did. I followed the blueprint to the letter, and it worked.
So can you explain why you left Morgan Keegan and became mayor?
I don't know if I can really explain the confluence of events of my contract, because we never have. Alan and I never have. But let me just say, whatever was written in the paper about a palace coup was not true. Alan did not want me to leave. Something happened that was not bad, but... And I wanted to leave. And I thought there was a different mission in life. I had accomplished what I thought I would do. I wasn't the CEO. Alan had just sent me to the round table. And something happened in my contract. And I said I should leave. And Alan didn't want me to leave. And finally, I was able to leave with cause and capture all of my contract in one day. And that made so that I didn't have to work anymore the rest of my life in many respects, unless I screwed something up. And then I went to Vermont, not knowing anything about Colorado, and thought my wife deserved a horse farm. You've met McKelly. She's the most lovely, wonderful person. I had a child who was five. She came to my front doorsteps. She treated Peter, and to this very day, to some difficult times, like, and she's not the mother, never tried to be her mother, his mother. His mother was Sabrina Laffey, now Sabrina, a different last name, wonderful lady herself. And she took care of these children, and she's just the most loyal, wonderful person I've ever met. And I, for some reason, I wanted 10 children, and I was already 32 and had one. And here was a lady who came into my life, and we had five more. So I decided I would start a hedge fund because I was a hot commodity running the focus list, Monkey. I didn't want to work for anybody else. I could have run for another division. They wanted me to run First Albany, another brokerage firm that would have had to wait out a year because of non-compete. So I go to Vermont. I can't buy a horse farm. I bid three times. And then I'm in Vermont on the edge of this. There's no mountains there compared to Colorado, but I'm on the edge of this. And I have this vision that I should go to Cranston, Rhode Island. And I didn't want to go. And we had a month left on the lease. It's Stowe, Vermont. It's beautiful there in the summer. No one should ever leave. And I say, Kelly, God wants me to go to Cranston, Rhode Island. and I don't want to go. I may have mentioned my childhood too much, but there was no way I was going back. And she says, if God wants you to go, we'll go. We go the next day with the kids. I have no idea what's going on. My wife sees this 1300, we live on the 8,000 square foot original mansion in Memphis in Peabody. And the reason I bought that was to make sure Alan knew that I was permanently going to live in Memphis. And I always lived in Midtown. I never lived out east. And then we go, and she likes this vinyl-sided 1,300 square foot home. I'm like, we don't fit in this home. We have a piano. She likes it. It's not for sale. She likes it. It's across the street from my childhood friends. On September 10th, my childhood friend Craig calls and says, it's going to be for sale. Go over there right now. So it's 10 o'clock at night. We go over, the guy wants $154,000 for this home. I'm like, I'm not going to fit in the bedroom. A king-size bed won't fit it. Anyway, we buy it. We're living there. And Cranston's missing $10 million in an article in the Providence Journal. And I go to City Hall and ask for the audit. That's what I do. And they don't have one for 3 years. And I know the bankrupt. Now, all of a sudden, I know the bankrupt. Like, I know. This is what, from the Harvard Business School guy who knew nothing, I know they're bankrupt. And it's my hometown. And because of the school system back in the day, and it's because of, and I pick up the phone, and I walk out, and I call my wife. And she's in Memphis selling the home on Peabody, 1554 Peabody, I guess. And I say, I know why God has me here. The town is going bankrupt, the city of Cranston, 83,000 people. I'm going to be the mayor and fix it. That's why I'm here. The rest of the story is in my book, Primary Mistake, where no one wants me to run. They tell me I can't run. The inside group, the old boys school, has a meeting and says I can't run. And I'm thinking I'm missing something in the charter, but I'm not. The guy who's going to run, they already have a candidate. They don't want me to run against him. He starts crying and walks out of the meeting. Now they only have me. Literally, the guy cried. He can't have a primary for whatever reason. So I run. I'm not supposed to win. And I run. I just want to make sure people, this is the part about the nation. I run on a message that is so in your face. And as I'm running, the bond rating is going down and the city council is doing stupid things. And it becomes the lowest bond rating in the United States of America. The city has 37 days. It's going to default on its debt. It's not going to make payroll. It's the worst thing since Bridgeport, Connecticut in 92, which really went bankrupt, declared bankruptcy. And I run a message that goes exactly like this. My name is Steve Laffey. I went to that public school. I went to Harvard Business School. I'm a financial expert. I will fix it, and you won't like anything I'm going to do, but I didn't come home to Cranston to live in Detroit. That's what I said. That's not really much of a winning message unless you're panicked. And because everybody became panicked, and because the Providence Journal, the New York Times of Rhode Island, paper record, put Cranston financial crisis in red letters on every article, and things just kept coming out. I won. I wasn't supposed to win. We did a poll in May, and people always talk about these polls. 500 people. One really liked me. One somewhat liked me. 498 people didn't know who I was. Mr. Laffey, how are the polls? Oh, they're going well. We have very low negatives. That was the only truthful thing I could say about the poll in May, and I won in November. The guy who ended up running, I destroyed the mayor in one meeting. He didn't run. He was never heard from again. They were trying to put everything into the pension obligation bond. Now I'm a financial expert, right? Not the kid at Harvard. You can't do that. You're going to go to jail. You didn't do an audit for 3 years. That's against the law. When you go down to see Merrill Lynch, they're going to ask for the audit. You're trying to put $25 million of current assets in a $250 million pension obligation bond. You're never going to do it, and you go to jail for it. That ended his career, right, that meeting. He didn't run. They put in the richest guy. So I won. And remember the guy who got me to taught me economics? Talk about building a team. Paul Zisserson, when I got going to run, retires from teaching economics in a public school and becomes my campaign manager. My high school principal, who's in the union, teachers union, Joe Venatulo, who when I was president of student council, would have me come into his office out of calculus, much to the chagrin of the teacher, have me suck down a lollipop and explain leadership techniques to me and ask me what he should do about broken windows, and I'd be like, here's what we should do. And he would make me go do it. We integrated in high school the first Down syndrome kids into the public schools and the first time in Rhode Island. And he said, you make sure no one makes fun of them. Get those people in different cliques and all these things we did. He becomes the honorary campaign chair. No one knows what to say. He's really a Democrat. Paul Zisserson retires because he loves the city. They all know the city's going down. Mr. Ordank, I grew up in his house. He comes along. He becomes the other one. He's a diehard Democrat, Jewish Rhode Islander. And he becomes Mr. X because he comes to my announcement and sits in the front row because his wife, Sylvia, who's like a mother to me, demands that he comes. He doesn't want to come. He runs the largest law firm in Rhode Island. It's all Democrats. But there he is in the front page of the paper, sitting there. So all this stuff happened, and it really was, you know, a God's hand in all this stuff. I knocked on every door. I loved doing it. And I told people the problems directly. And there was only one time so far in my life where it worked. I've done it before. I've done it after. I've done it in the Senate race. I did it in Colorado. That wasn't really much of a race. I just did it in 8 months running for president. Nobody's listening. But the people of Cranston did. And building a team, my director of administration now runs McKinney, Texas. He had never done this before. As I try to explain the presidential race, my people don't go to jail. They go into bigger and better things working for me. Call Paul Grimes right now. He's a wonderful guy. Call Tavis McCord at Raymond James. I call a bunch of people. But we built a team, and the bond rating went up the most in the history of the United States of America over 3.5 years. 8 notches. Never been done in American history. The city, instead of having negative $20 million when I left office, had $23 million in the bank. The bond rating was investment grade. And I'll give you just one example. The 9-0 Democratic City Council, the Democratic mayor, decided they would take all the money out of the pension plan before I became mayor or as I become mayor. So the bond rating gets crushed. They buy a piece of polluted land to build a police station on as a SOP for the unions. Everything in Rhode Island is about unions, public sector unions. I have to go to the guy and say, we can't buy the property. I'm going to have to expose this. He says, I don't want you to do that. He's a great guy. I have to go to the police union, which is about to have a riot because they're not going to get, they need a new police station. And I say, listen to me carefully. When the bond rating goes to investment grade, whatever that is, and we can borrow it normal money, I will build a police station. We're not a debt-laden city. We could do that. We can't do it now. These people, they're mad. 2 years later, the bond rating goes to investment grade. It went up higher after that. I told Paul Grimes, the director of administration, call the meeting at the police station tomorrow. Big press release. We're building a police station. Before I left office, that police station was built and standing there. That's what I do.
How would you compare your time at Morgan Keegan versus your time as mayor?
The job as mayor had no support. There was no Alan Morgan. There was no John Stokes. There was just a rabid group of firemen who were totally out of shape, who gamed the system whenever they could, who started a riot at the city hall, who were luckily pretty dumb. The police union people were average and got along with. But there was nobody to back. I was now, from the very beginning, the guy. And everybody took pot shots. if they could spread rumor about me, Aaron Garabedian, the guy who I defeated, you know, he started spreading rumors that I'm having an affair with my executive assistant, who I went to 7th grade with, Jackie. So I tell Jackie and Kelly, my wife, go sit next to them at Panera Bread. They sit there every morning and laugh and joke a while. And they do, and that ends that. People follow me around. At restaurants, some people won't let me pay. And I'm thinking, they got a camera on me. So I would say to whoever it was, how much? And I'd hold up two $20 bills and wave it like a camera and put it down. But it was very meaningful. Remember, it's a middle-class city. It looks pretty nice. There's not a lot of crime for whatever reason, even though Providence has crime next door. And the people love Cranston. And I love Cranston. I grew up there. And it gets fixed. It's the most satisfying thing that people can get mortgages. We had major lawsuits against the school. I had to sue every member of the school committee personally for $1 million because they wouldn't balance the budget. The city charter says they should. We won major cases that should have been put in place in other cities that the city charter trumps a union contract. We won. We won at the state Supreme Court of all Democrats. They couldn't rule against me. I hired the best. I'll give you an example. The fire union comes in as I become mayor-elect, and they're like, hey, you're not hiring that guy, Vinny Ragusta, to whatever you do. Don't hire him as your lawyer. He just wastes money. I'm like, are these guys dumb? Why would they tell me this? They leave. I call Vinny Ragusta. He's the greatest labor attorney in the state. He becomes a fast friend. He handles all these cases. We win every single arbitration, 23-0 against the unions. So it was overwhelming victory. Here's the problem. Much like Morgan Keegan in this sense, I win these things because at certain meetings when I'm raising taxes and cutting, 1,500 people show up to go to a city council meeting. Can you do that in Memphis? You've never seen this in Memphis. I have videos of it. People screaming. I get all 9 members of the city council to agree on every one of my budgets because these people, while they're mad, are not mad at me. A great blessing. I didn't live there for 20 years. How could they be? I wasn't there. I'm just this kid who came home that people generally liked, who didn't mince words, and I cut spending. I did everything I could to get it back on track. And everybody suffered. And part of being a leader is just this. And this is what I was would do as president. When I had to cut the budget, another 1,500 people came in. The unions were going to start a riot. I called up Billy Bennett. Remember the Bennett family? He's 6'6". He's the toughest guy in the city. I said, Billy, little Stevie, what are you doing? Mayor, can you come here, come on the stage, shake my hand, sit in the front row and glare at these people? There won't be a riot. He did. These are real stories. He comes up, gives me a hug, sits in the front row. He's the biggest guy in this. He's 6'6". He must be 60-something, 60. He still looks like he could play in the NHL. So when I was cutting everything out of the budget, I thought to myself, much like at Morgan Keegan, I'm going to make them watch every single thing. Every single thing. They're going to be transparent. I'm cutting square dancing at the senior center. I'm cutting $30,000 of state payments for electricity. I'm just not going to pay. They can turn the lights off. I'm doing this. I'm cutting this. I'm going after this union. And you know what? 1,500 people start cheering. I have the videotape of it. I become the mayor of Rhode Island that night because it's never happened. And when I'm done cutting everything and destroying people's, you know, what they thought was going to be normal, senior center cuts, there's a lady on TV going, it just had to be done. Because you know what? Like at Morgan Keegan and why I couldn't accept some things that and left. Everybody knew my power came from one thing. I didn't give a rat's ass about anybody individually. I love them as a Christian. Everybody got treated the same. And they knew it that night that it was different than the other mayors. And they cheered. And they came to meetings. And I won every single case until my third, fourth year mayor. People stopped coming. Because what people would say, Mayor, you take care of that. You take care of that. I go, no, not actually me. You took care of that by coming. And when they stopped coming, I lost the vote, a small vote, about privatizing the garage where we kept snow and stuff, snow stuff, track. And I knew that I wasn't going to stay anyway. We fixed everything. I had a little cheat sheet. We're going to do this. We're going to do that, bond rate. I'm not going to be mayor. I'm not going to stick. And that's what happens. That's a difference. But I will tell you the other thing that happens in politics. When I told the group around me, I'm not going to be the mayor any longer. Here's the checklist we were going to do. 8 things. They're done. Police station's going to... They're like, no, because people got used to hanging around. I'm only the mayor of Cranston. I mean, it's not that big. But for most people in politics, no matter what, it's big. You go with Laffy here. He's there. He's on TV. I'm not saying they're bad. They're wonderful people, but they get caught up in it. I just don't. That's why I've never been addicted to things. You know, in a sense, I'm by the grace of God, I wasn't addicted to being mayor.
Is there any benefit in your life that not drinking alcohol has created?
Yes. I don't think anybody should. I'm not going to, if I was president, I wouldn't go for prohibition. That wouldn't work. But drinking alcohol, it is a gateway drug. I've watched it my entire life. And I said this to myself as a young person. People out here are drinking. Like, there's never anything good that happens. Like, nothing of my friends growing up with, you could go find Eddie Kern right now, who walked, he's in my book. I love him. He's like a brother. Those guys protected me because they're like, he's going to college, but they'd be drinking. People would come walk with their kids on the campaign and say, you, Mayor Laffy, I grew up with him. They didn't do this kind of stuff, but they came with me and they would tell their kids, listen to Mayor Laffy. We all know, I mean, I hate to say this, we all know, I don't like that statement, but people know it's not good for you. Why are we doing this? But for me, I saw what it did to my brothers. I saw mixing alcohol and drugs. I saw it needles in the arm eventually. I saw it lead to other things. And I never did it. And it's not that I'm better. I don't feel like that. I'm just like, wow, how did God make me realize? Remember, I hung around with older people. I drove a car at 13 because other people were drinking who were older friends. And I drove them home in their parents' car without a license. But I didn't drink. And somehow I knew how to drive a car. But I've never seen it do anything good. And in Memphis, in the South, people drink a lot. And at Morgan Keegan, they drank a real lot. At dinner the first night when all the people were around, Graves was, I thought he was looking at me. He wasn't looking at me. Everybody had liquor on the table and they had a glass of whatever for me, but I didn't touch it. I didn't say I didn't drink. I just touched it. And finally, Haywood said something like, I don't know if you guys know, but Laffy obviously doesn't drink. He reaches over, grabs the thing. It was funny. But I wish people didn't drink. Now, we don't have any alcohol in my home. None of my kids happen to drink. This is maybe the one thing I share with Donald Trump. I've heard him speak about this and his brother dying of alcohol poisoning, I guess, and very heartfelt. The only heartfelt thing I saw him do. It just doesn't lead to anything good. It leads to all bad things. I wish people would realize that.
What'd you get wrong? You talked about failure in your judgment, your thought, your planning with the Senate and the House and presidential election.
I thought in running for the U.S. Senate, and my book Primary Mistake through Penguin Books goes through this, I thought that we had done, in business, when I took over biggest producer with Alan, I got to get management. I'm the research director. When the research director was cooking and going and on TV and gathering, I became the head of institutional sales, head of the trading desk. Everything had to be the president. Everything was successful. Everything I touched worked out. In Cranston, everything worked out. How could they not make me the U.S. senator? I mean, everything I told you would happen. And now I'm talking about we shouldn't be trading with China. In 2006, it's going to turn out really bad. There'll never be a democracy. Everybody else is saying, oh, no, they're going to be fine. I'm totally right. In politics, being right. I've been right about everything. Everything in my movie, Fixing America, is right. China's a giant problem. I made it in 2011. I said in the movie, when we pass $20 trillion of borrowed debt, we're never going back. We won't pay the interest on the debt. There's a one-minute video you can go watch where everything explodes. And now we're at $26 trillion and 27 maybe now. Being right doesn't help in politics. The world is so upside down that we've elected the worst people to run everything that I can find. And good people won't do it. How many times have people like, again, I met Ed Wiziger. I can live vicariously through you. I'm not doing it. I'm not putting up with this nonsense. I can't blame them. I may be the only person that for 20, how many years, have done this, fixed Cranston, and then totally failed. Like, I have failed to get to the U.S. Senate. When we ran for Congress in Colorado, unfortunately, it was a three-month race, and I couldn't meet everybody. I really would have won that race if I had a year. I had 3 months in a special election. And I would say about Ken Buck, very conservative guy. By the way, he's a great guy. My son became his intern the next summer. I said this truthfully. Ken Buck's really boring. He's going to go there. No one in the nation will know who he is. He's not going to make the changes. I'm Jack Kemp. Let me go. We'll vote the same way, but I'll be on the steps so that's, and I'm going to make people change their votes. And you're going to hear about this new law. And we're going to not trade with China. And I didn't get to do that. And then I didn't think I'd become president in this race. But I thought there had to be, because it's been haunting me. The country's destroyed. It's destroyed by both parties. It's destroyed by everybody in it. There's nobody you can point to. And I thought if I ran for president, that maybe there'd be a shot because I became friends with Herman Cain, who took off like a rocket in 2011. And I became friends with him afterwards. In Colorado, went to see him in Florida. He told me what to do. He thought I should run. He unfortunately passed away of the Chinese virus because he had cancer and he went to a Trump rally. Anyway, I would have told him not to go. But he would have been a good president. But he had no knowledge of foreign policy, as he told me. Totally great guy. I did what he did. It didn't work. I put forth, if you go to the website, they're still there, five policies that would fix the country and five policies that Donald Trump can't argue with. He can't debate me. If I can get into that debate, Social Security is not going to touch. Why are we destroying young people's lives who won't get it? If you're listening right now and you're under 50, you're never getting it, ever. I have a plan to fix it. It's not even my plan. It's Larry Kotlikoff's, a senior genius economic guy, 71-year-old at BU. The Federal Reserve has to keep, inflation at zero. We have to do away with the dual mandate. These are things that we can do that 80% of the people are like, oh, okay. When they hear it, they're like, yeah, it's not a party thing. There are things like that. We have to get everybody out of the public schools. They don't work. They're worse. And now as president, I can't do that by fiat. We're going to be a cheerleader like President Kennedy was for physical fitness. By the way, I'd be a candidate for physical fitness. We have a giant obesity problem. I talk about it all the time. Not to make fun of people, just that we can't, we have $1 trillion in extra spending on healthcare in America. We can't go from 18% of GDP to 12 with people being obese. I always say, ever been to Switzerland? They were 12% of GDP on the healthcare. They have great healthcare. Ever see a really fat person in Switzerland? I have yet to see them. I'm not making fun of people, and I'm in the deep south saying this. We can't do this. We're going to have to say to people, we're not going to replace your knee at 53. You weigh 400 pounds. You're drinking a gallon of brew every day. We're going to put you in a cycle where we can get you better, but if you don't want to get better, we can't do it. Now, These are the things I said to people in Cranston, different policies because I'm talking. And I got to tell you, the difference of people who go to these rallies in New Hampshire from what I saw years ago is vastly different. It's like a sideshow for people. Really good people have checked out. They won't go.
What will the United States look like 25 years from now?
I actually think that what will happen and why I ran for president for so long and got so little traction, although I was on Good Morning America and I'm on Newsmax and I was banned from Newsmax because Trump didn't like me. But I went back on because Bob Sellers liked me. And so there's a body of work that is the truth. And I thought that at the very least I could be that Johnny Appleseed, although no one else would do it. Vivek Ramaswamy, people are running there. They're complete backstabbers and sycophants. And those people will never catch on. I thought I had a chance to catch on. I think what will happen is that it'll be better. And here's what's going to happen. We're going to hit the crisis point over the next 24 months. It can't now not be avoided. We can't lower interest rates without running up inflation. We can't raise interest rates because we can't pay the interest on the debt. We can't pay the interest on the debt. It's going to be $1 trillion. We only collect $4.5 trillion. I can go on all about this stuff. We've never had a $2 trillion deficit with unemployment at 3.7%. So this is the part I could do all day long. I won't go to all the numbers. We're going to hit the wall, and we're going to have a day of reckoning that we haven't seen since the Great Depression. And leaders will emerge. If it's not me, it'll be someone like me. I hope it's me. I hope someone says, listening to the show, that guy Laffey, I went and looked, he's right. And when it happens, there was a guy who said this in 06. He said, China... He said he made a movie that's like a secular journey. He was right about everything. He ran for president and told us what we had to do. That was the ninth inning. My last speech that I gave was after Mike Pence spoke. He said, 500 people listening in New Hampshire on TV, I think it's morning in America. And I get up and say something, I'll paraphrase now. It's like the bottom of the ninth. There's two outs. Rivera just showed up at the plate. We're down by 5 runs. He's going to throw me a cutter with 2 strikes. That's where America is today. It's not morning in America, folks. This is a complete lie. And if you like that kind of talk, you're not going to like what I have to say. I can only give the Cranston speech. I don't have another way of speaking to my detriment. If I was Lindsey Graham, never been married, have no kids, spent 40 years in politics, I'd be a U.S. senator. If I was born in Mississippi, I'd be a U.S. senator. I was born in Rhode Island. I'm a very conservative, evangelical person. The time will come when this all will change. It'll change rapidly, but it'll change when something like the president and Congress decide to pay not 5% on cash on U.S. treasuries because we're paying $1.2 trillion in debt. They're going to change it all to 1%. And so we have $40 trillion of debt. It'll be $400 billion again of payments on interest. Everybody will lose. These are the kind of things that are going to happen. I just suggested we change the tax system so we could collect a lot more money. That's why we need a fair tax, a flat tax, or Herman Cain's 999, which I told him to his face in 2012, would have to be like 12, 12, 12.
So you're saying 24 months from now, we will be at rock bottom. Just
all
like
hell, hell will break loose in this country.
Can you describe what that will look like?
It will look like people who thought they were safe in treasuries are not safe. It will look like high unemployment. It will look at high real interest rates. Because, folks, Janet Yellen today or in November got the stock market up because she refused to issue by law as many 10-year or 20-year or 30-year bonds and went even shorter to issue treasuries. You don't have to be a financial genius to know that companies don't go broke because they have too much debt. They have too much debt due tomorrow. And the rollover risk of America with the duration of our bonds gets shorter and shorter. It's now like 6 years, not 15 years like people think it is if you ask them. And now we can't roll this debt. Every debt we're rolling that comes off, $7.6 trillion this year, comes off at 1%. I'm making up rough numbers. Has to be issued at 4 or 5%. They can't issue these 10-year bonds. No one's going to buy them. So they're issuing three-month treasury bills. They're moving shorter. This will explode. It exploded on Chesapeake Energy. We could go through companies that we dealt with at Morgan Keegan. It's happening now. It's not like I said in 2011, if we don't, blah, blah, blah. It's actually now has to happen. And so the middle class will get hurt the worst. Social Security people will get their checks. So if you get Social Security and you're 67, you're still going to get it. This is going to change the inflation gauge it matches to. Inflation will run at 7%. They'll adjust it to something that will go up by 2%, and you'll lose 5% every year. from 2020 to today. If you made 100 grand then and make 100 grand now, you're down $15,000 in spending power. You're down $15,000. You don't know it. You do know it. That's why you're upset. That's why unemployment's 3.7 and everybody thinks the country's in the wrong direction. Your kids will not have the life you had. They can't. We can fix it. We will have to fix it. Americans will rise up and fix it, and we will throw these people out. It's just not going to be this cycle, it looks like.
Who will win the next election?
If it's Trump-Biden, which I don't think it will, Trump will win. People have had it with Biden. I've always thought that the Democrats are much more unified of what has to happen. Biden, in a month or two, I could be wrong, will make a speech that he's too old, very gracefully. Mrs. Harris won't run. She's a disaster. And somebody else will be put in and will defeat Trump. So anybody else would defeat Trump.
Do you have a guess who you think that may be?
Could be Governor Newsom.
You think?
That's why he went on Fox News. These are all things I don't know.
Right. It's a projection.
I do know we're broke. I do know what some of the solutions will be.
So what would that look like 2 years from now when the reckoning happens with that administration?
They will go for more power and they will control your lives. And if you thought the Chinese virus, which should be called the Chinese virus, it started in China, you thought that was bad. They will go for more control and people will rise up.
But I thought you said that this was an opportunity.
It is an opportunity. But if Gavin Newsom is president, there'll probably be a Republican Congress because people are smart enough to know we don't want the whole thing run by one party. Nothing will get done on lots of issues. And something will happen for people to rise up and say no more of this.
So you think there'll be 2 years of pain until the next cycle?
Well, I would say if I was elected president, there'd be 1 or 2 years of real pain. I told people this. But we would go in the right direction.
It would be operational pain is what you're
saying.
Yes,
like in Cranston.
Correct.
There were higher taxes. There were lower services. Sorry, 86% under contract.
But my point, or I guess me reflecting back on you, is what I think I hear you're saying. If it's a Biden-Trump election, you think Trump would win.
I do.
But you don't think that Biden will run.
So I still think, and it's too close to, I said by end of February back about 6 months ago, it could be that Biden just runs and they just run it into the ground and Trump gets elected. And as I said in 2015, when he first announced, I said he's going to win. And people, I have tapes of this. People thought I was nuts. They thought it was a joke. I said, no. On swing states, I made this movie. I drove the country. I went to these places, a lot of them. And as a guy who was making 80 grand, who knows his job is in China, he's making 45, working two jobs. He's lined at night. He worked for a ball bearing. He didn't even work for Ford. He worked for some ball bearing company in Western Pennsylvania. He's working two jobs. His kid's on fentanyl. He's like, if someone says China, I'm in. And the problem with Donald Trump is he does not have an ideology. Like I have an idea. You could look at what I've done and what I've said. I do exactly that. He has no ideology. He is a narcissist. He has a disease. I feel bad for him. If you go look up what a narcissist does and says and so forth, they have envy for other people. They change their mind. They only hang around with really important people. They say you're the best guy until they disagree that you're the worst lawyer. And if it didn't affect the country, I'd be fine. If you just picked those great judges, which he did, which I gave him compliments for, I'd be happy. But his ideology is not one. It's a Donald Trump ideology. So he says the most ridiculous things, but we live in a world where that's okay. When Ted Kennedy told Roger Mudd said, why are you running for president? And he wasn't prepared. His career was over. Ted Kennedy went back to the Senate. He was never going to be president. He didn't know why he was running. I knew why I was running. You can now say whatever you want. It doesn't hurt you. When Trump said I could shoot a guy in the street and I probably, this is the problem in the country. My party, my former party, I left the Republican Party. I'll go back. They just want to fight. The people in New Hampshire just wanted to fight with Democrats. I had a guy who worked for the Federal Reserve come up to me after I made my speech. That was the greatest thing I ever heard. Big tall guy. I worked 45 years for the Fed. You're the only guy who knows the numbers. You actually know. You know what's going to happen. Steve, the guy to my right and the guy to my left, they don't want to do it right now. I'm not sure they're picking up on the fact that it has to be done. But you are right. So I hate to laugh because it's a very sad thing to say. So I don't know the end game. I don't know what it'll be, but I do know we can't take inflation down to zero with what we're doing and spending. These are just mathematical things that are true. We can't take rates down to zero and get people to buy homes again because inflation would be The dollar would collapse. They know this. We can't keep raising rates because the real rates will be too high. The economy will cease to function. We have an economy now that's so deformed. In other words, before 08, it was sort of not deformed. But with what happened in 08, which we won't go into, and the bank should have went to zero, and the economy is so deformed with rates so low that everybody bought something out that they didn't need. That's what you do when rates are that low. And so getting back to normal, they haven't tried. But getting back to normal is very hard. That's why people think there's a recession but doesn't come, because people still have spending money. The money supply is up above a historical graph. It's coming back down. But until it gets to that historical number and below it, people may still have enough money. Young people are like nihilists today. The world's ending. I can't buy a home. Let's go to Bermuda. You see consumer spending continue to go. Consumer credit's up another 5% last quarter. This is strange stuff. It's because those people running the country from Bush at the end and the next set of people have deformed it that we don't have capitalism. And it's hard to figure out. It's harder for me to figure out stocks, because some things that are so overvalued, without getting into it, keep going up. So this is a very difficult time for everybody. And it's a difficult time to have what we need in capitalism is a rule of law and some certainty. So when Biden decides to take a 2-week thing on LNG not being permitted, the guy who's going to spend $600 billion on the next play is like, I can't do that. It hurts. But the people running the country from Trump to Obama, they don't care. And this is the thing you have to understand. I've met Chuck Schumer. He doesn't care. They're in power. You let them be in power, and they don't care. And you haven't elected someone like me since Cranston, and I do care. And I would do things that would restore the middle class that are simple, they're easy to understand. And nobody really wants it right now, because they're just going to have a party until it's over.
Last question I have. What are your principles that you can share to someone listening to this about how to actually think for yourself?
One thing, I've homeschooled my children for the most part since 2007. I personally homeschooled the last three. And there's one thing I can tell you is that you need to turn off the TV and not watch the news. You need to learn how to get your numbers and facts from certain sources that are more impartial. You can't go to Yahoo. I'm sorry to bring, you can't go to these things. The world is so out of control. And I would say this very humbly. Since 2000, when the internet sort of really came around, there is nothing that's better. The school systems aren't better. There's more pornography. We could go on a litany of things. People aren't more educated. People don't know how to make change who are 23. If you're listening to this and you're young, you have to think for yourself and say, where would I get my data from? You can get the data from the Federal Reserve, the St. Louis Federal Reserve. You can look at things, raw data. You can make decisions. You can find people who just only tell the truth. It's hard to do, but if you're listening to the mass media, if you're turning on, and again, if you're turning on Fox News, I turned it off 8-9 years ago. It's just clutter. It's an opinion show. At one point, Bill O'Reilly said there was one person in charge of the oil market, blah, blah, blah. I was like, oh my gosh, someone's listening. They don't know any better. They would think that's true. There's a lot of things you can do. I have lots of friends who went to college with, not business school, who totally have the wrong picture. They think the 2020 election was a scam. It wasn't, folks. Trump lost 63 decisions to some of the judges that he appointed. Now, should we have a much better system? Should it ever be on the internet? Of course not. Did any of your elected officials in any state change the election system so you feel comfortable after all the information's come out? None of them did. Not conservative states. You should be able to walk into a voting booth. Someone should challenge, Laffy doesn't live here, Democrat. You should have a paper ballot. It should go into a box. They should count it. It should be chained at night by state troopers and a Democrat, Republican. And then when there's a challenge, you can pull it out. It should not touch the internet. I said something very simple that anybody listening would be like, yeah, why wouldn't we do that? Take a little more work. We don't do it in Pennsylvania. So you're going to have problems. But remember, your elected officials are in on it. They didn't want it. They don't want term limits. They don't want the middle class to be restored. They want to get out on this musical chair game like the mayor of Cranston before me thought he was. He thought he'd be lieutenant governor and then governor. I crashed his party. He never was heard from again. We have to crash the party, and so they're never heard of again. you have to not only get the good information, you have to do what you can do. And everybody, you can go to a school committee meeting. You can write a letter to the editor. You can get up tomorrow morning. I hate to sound like the movie Scrooge at the very end, right? Bill Murray, like, we can do, you can, if you're not doing something, you're not doing anything. Do what you can do. Teach your kids the truth. Homeschool them. Don't send them to that public school tomorrow. Stop. I was with a guy in Fort Collins. What can you do? He said, oh, he saw my kids. And he's like, wow, I think I lost my 12-year-old last week. She just changed. I said, what did she do? He told me he went to public school. I said, listen, I don't care what it costs you. You get her out of that school tomorrow morning, Monday morning. It was a Saturday. He goes, what? I said, you love your kid? What do you love more than your kid other than Jesus? What do you love more? Your wife? Okay. What do you love more than that? What are you willing to do to see that that doesn't turn into a disaster? A death, a fentanyl disaster, an abortion, whatever's going to come from these bad decisions that being done right then, that you know now. You now know. You became aware. He said, okay. I don't know what he did.
Had he not then live in a very biased, narrow-minded way?
I have friends who are Jews. I have friends who are Hindus. I mean, I don't want to sound like, hey, my friends are all black. They're not. I don't have very many black friends. I just didn't grow up like that. I have some. You can't be, and I see this in evangelical churches a lot. You can't just be cloistered with all these people. We're not going to do that. We're going to go get some missionaries. That's great. Wonderful. You got to get out. You've got to talk to people. You've got to have friends that disagree with you. This is the old way. My friends and I disagree on a lot of things. Danny Ordway, his son is in Hawaii. He's like, disagrees with me. We talk about it. But you won't get to the truth of what you can do unless you have lots of different thoughts.
Thank you.
This is a unique interview for me. I do talk about a lot of things, but your questions have been ones I quite frankly have not been asked. And I know I go off on stories, but I think they're important. And I'm not done. I haven't given up. I had to get out of the race. I think God has a plan. Maybe not for me. Maybe it's my son. Maybe it's someone I met on the campaign trail. Whatever it may be, I've done the plan and I'm satisfied with that. And my wife loves me. My six kids love me. And that's good enough. And I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Driven By Podcast. If you enjoy the show, please leave a review. Please subscribe to the show, and you can follow me on social, on Twitter and Instagram, to join me for future episodes of the Driven By Podcast. Hope you have a great week, and see you next time.